This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, command language to
put its hands where I can see them.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal Allusionist. Does that work? I don't know.
That's Phoebe Judge from Criminal, which is a two-person operation.
My name is Lauren Spohr, and I'm the co-creator of Criminal.
Now, Criminal have a much more linguistically exacting job than most of us podcasters. I can bandy words around willy-nilly with very few likely repercussions, but since they're talking about serious and often traumatic events in real people's lives, if they're not careful, there could be significant emotional and legal consequences.
A lot of the topics in the shows that we bring up, you know, we are dealing with material that, you know, the words that we're using can be very triggering and sensitive to some people, and we do take it very seriously. We argue over one word, and we go back and forth over one word so often. I think every script, there's one word that Lauren wants or I want that the other one thinks is just wild, and we go back and forth and back and forth, tracking it two different ways just to see. And it can just be about one word.
There's also a tricky linguistic balance to strike when reporting on crime. At one end, there's a style which is so dry and technical, it makes the story sound, well, boring. And there's also some danger of making it seem detached from the real damage it caused to people. At the other end of the scale, there's crime reporting that is as splashy and sensational as fiction.
I hope we're never accused of sensationalizing a crime or a story or a person. I think that we're very, maybe hyper aware of that, just because I think so often in crime reporting, you find that sensationalism.
I'm interested in these people, and I'm interested in, you know, the way that they think about themselves and what happened to them or what they did. And so we sort of let them tell their story from a completely first person point of view. We always try to get them to reflect on their experience in some way. And then we take that tape and we go through it and we say, okay, how do they know that? How do they know that? And then we sort of seek out court documents and primary sources so we can sort of vet their first person experience. So we end up leaving a lot of really, I think, fascinating and charming pieces of tape on the floor just because we can't back them up and we're not going to take that chance.
And at the same time, I think that while we're not trying to sensationalize anything, we're very deliberate about the stories that we do choose and the crimes that we do choose to highlight in our stories. And so we're not going to pick a story that doesn't have the elements that are ripe to make it interesting. And so I think by being so careful on the front end about the stories that we do find, we don't have to then sensationalize the material once we're telling the story because we find this actual story that we've chosen to be so interesting.
They also have to be sensitive to how vocabulary shifts over time. For example, in recent years, I've noticed a lot more objection to the word victim, as it rather dehumanizes the person in question and deprives them of agency and power.
I'm seeing more and more use of the term survivor, like survivor of sexual violence, survivor of sexual assault, as opposed to victim.
Victim derives from the Latin victima, a person or animal killed as a sacrifice, which is another mark against it. Actually, I wonder whether nouns are problematic more widely when describing the people connected to crimes. This also applies to the people who perpetrated these crimes. Thief, murderer, burglar. The noun characterizes the person solely as their criminal act.
I mean, there's power to words like murder and certainly murderer. We interviewed a man who was a murderer, and he had killed a man, and the way that his comfort in saying that, you know, I murdered someone, I'm a murderer, was so very surprising to me because it's something that I think that I don't know how you could ever be comfortable using that label for yourself, even if it's true. But he seemed to have a different understanding of it. It was an act, and it put him in the certain category of being called, you know, now a murderer, but that's not the only thing that he was. And so he could say it much more freely than maybe I would be able to say it to him. You're a murderer now. And I think one time maybe I was even shying away from using that sentence. And he said, yeah, I murdered someone, you know, and he finished it for me. So I think we've had experiences where we're dealing with these situations which are very dire. And the people that we're speaking to have surprised us because we've been trying to be incredibly respectful and maybe tiptoe a bit around these terms, and they're the ones who just come out and say it.
Do you think he was like that because he was proud to be a murderer, or because he was like, I've got to face it and not hide the act because I'm repentant about it?
Yes, I think that he wasn't proud to be a murderer. I think that he had come to terms with it.
Very early on, in their second ever episode indeed, Criminal made a show about lying, which I thought you'd be interested in because lying is a linguistic act, the spoken language often belied by the body language. Lauren and Phoebe have very generously said that I could play this episode here for you in a moment, but I wanted to ask them about lying and how they deal with subjects who are not completely candid.
I can't really think about a time where I've been interviewing someone where I've thought, oh, you're lying. I'm going to have to call you out on this or not be able to use the tape. And I think that that's because if someone agrees to be interviewed by us, they're pretty much, I think, okay with telling their story. And if they're going to need to lie or be embarrassed or try to change the truth, they probably will just decline the interview.
There is a way in which people, and this is something that I think we all do all the time, I think people tell their stories in a way that potentially is sort of putting themselves in the most sympathetic light, right? So I'm not saying that's lying at all, but it's a sort of like version of events that's, you know, we sort of engineer these things in our minds. So, you know, if I'm telling a story from my point of view, I'm obviously going to sort of favor my perspective on things, which is, you know, not a lie, but it's, I don't think there's a lot of objectivity here in the first place.
There are times when I think I'll talk to someone and I'll say, ask them a direct question, and they'll totally just be evasive and not try to answer it. But I don't think I've been directly lied to yet.
Or maybe you're just very trusting.
Maybe people lie to me all the time.
Well, Phoebe, learn what to look out for from yourself. Here's Criminal's Pants on Fire.
What about those that have been trained to lie? You know, this is they know how to do this. They know how to lie in an interrogation. Is that possible? Are we able to train people to lie?
Oh, people lie all the time. I don't know if you have to be trained. I think people learn as they grow up. There's all kinds of lies people can tell, right? You can tell lies about the past, the future, yourself, other people. You can lie for fun. You can lie to not be punished. You can lie because it's your job. If you're a professional working undercover, you have to lie. You can tell lies about what you did or what you will do. Those are all different kinds of lies. So in the context of when people are being questioned by the police, there's a number of ways in which a person could look, if they are deceptive, could look absolutely normal. Whereas a truthful person might actually be frightened of the police, and they, ironically, would look deceptive.
There's this thought that if you want to know if someone is lying, you should be able to tell by just looking at them, that people give off signals of dishonesty. This is huge in TV shows like Sherlock and Lie to Me.
Classic one-sided shrug. Translation, I have absolutely no confidence in what I just said. The body contradicts the words. He's lying.
It feels so compelling that you should be able to recognize, you know, fear, disgust, anger, sadness, and that these are universal expressions. And I think that it's true that around the planet, by and large, many emotions are expressed similarly by the facial muscles. Not entirely, but similarly. What's really, I think, more questionable scientifically is whether or not these expressions or micro facial expressions, these quick flashes of human emotions on your face, are actually signals of lying.
So if your body doesn't matter the way we've thought it has for so long, then what does? I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal. For 20 years, Andy Morgan has been studying human memory and deception. He's worked with the FBI, CIA, the military, law enforcement groups. And it goes without saying that all those people Morgan worked with, they really like to know when someone's lying to them. They will do some crazy, expensive, exhaustive things to find out if someone's lying to them. But what we're learning now is that a lot of those things they've been trying, they just don't work. We've been looking for physiological clues since the 1920s with the invention of the lie detector.
This is the Reed polygraph, a lie detector. In the past 20 years, an estimated 200,000 persons have staked their futures, many of them their lives, on this machine.
The polygraph, as you know, is a device that records how fast you're breathing, sort of your respiration rate, and how much your chest is moving. They put tubes around your chest. And the general belief in law enforcement and within the polygraph community for years has been rooted in the idea that we call the fear and alarm hypothesis.
That variations in blood pressure and pulse rate are present during and after the act of lying.
That telling a lie is threatening in some way, and that threat to you will trigger a difference, a shift.
The conscious act of lying creates an emotional disturbance.
And cause your blood pressure to rise, or your skin conductance to go up, or your respiration rate to change, like holding your breath or maybe breathing more rapidly.
Now, it may not shock you that the polygraph isn't a perfect tool, but we were actually surprised to learn just how inaccurate the machine is.
We actually know the polygraph, in the way it is mainly used, is not better than chance. At detecting deception, maybe slightly at 52, 52%, 53%.
You could literally flip a coin and be just as accurate as the polygraph at detecting a lie. But the idea that your body gives you away is still very much alive. It's still being used in police departments all over the country. Cops are trained to read body language. Some investigators claim they can watch an interrogation with the sound off and know if someone's lying. But what Andy Morgan says is that when put to the test, people aren't any better at sensing a lie than chance. And if that's true, that we can't see a lie, that we can't hear a lie or smell a lie, or physically sense in any way when someone's playing us, then what do? About a decade ago, Morgan and some colleagues decided to test a different technique. They started interviewing people from all over the world, about 1,200 of them.
So ranging from white Brits to Chinese, East Indians, Lebanese, Jordanians, Moroccans, Sudanese, Afghans, Iraqis, Vietnamese, Russians. My colleagues and I have tried to study people inside and outside the United States. And we've mainly used a particular technique called cognitive interviewing.
Cognitive interviewing is based on the premise that memory doesn't work like a video camera. There are sights and sounds and smells stored deep in your brain that can all be recalled if pushed hard enough. So every time Morgan sat down to interview an American or a Jordanian, some of them would be lying and others would be telling the truth. And he would ask them to do something pretty simple.
To tell us a story about what they've been doing.
The most memorable concert that I have been to. It's not the best. It's the most memorable.
So obviously this isn't actually tape from Morgan's research. We just put some of our friends to the test.
Was Yesair about a year ago.
I went to a Foo Fighters concert in 2005 for the In Your Honor tour.
And then say, so if you imagine for a minute that I was there with you, what would I have seen if I'd been there with you the entire time?
They had the lights programmed with the music, and so the mirrors really, like, reflected the light, and so there was, like, it would form shapes.
Then we say, when they're done, so I think I'm getting a better picture in my head. So imagine for a moment I was with you, but this time I was blind, and I could only listen. What would I have heard during that time?
So it's more of a shuffling of, like, rubber against pavement there. Go down metal steps, go down to the car, our car doors open.
You know, depending on the context, you might say, what would I have smelled?
There was this girl that was standing next to me who was in a sweater dress. Who did not wear deodorant.
And then we say, starting with the very last thing that happened, what do you remember happening right before that?
Leave dorm.
Right before that.
Go walk backwards to car.
Right before that.
Get in car. Come back to dorm.
Kind of having them just walk us backwards through their memory.
Crunching guitars and awesome drum stuff.
What's been found over the years in many studies of cognitive interviewing is that using those mnemonic prompts, those sensory prompts, what you would have seen, heard, smelled, thought, touched, or tasted, they trigger more memory recall. You get more detail. The picture becomes much more rich and complex without suggesting anything specific to the person you're interviewing.
But here's where things get interesting. Turns out, if you're telling a lie, a made-up story, even one that's well-rehearsed, you can't complete this interview, not without giving yourself away.
If you tell a very simple lie, there's not much work to do. You go, I don't know. And you have nothing to say. Kids do that all the time. But if you're telling a story that's reasonably complicated and it's supposed to be believable, because if I'm lying to you, my goal is to sell you the story I'm telling you and then to leave before you figure out it's not true. or not to bring up anything that might lead you to suspect that it's not true. I'm trying to tell my story and stick to it. We find that liars are often worried that if they're inconsistent, they will be thought to be lying. So what they do is they tell you a story. So if I say, tell me everything that happened, they might tell me quite a wonderful story.
I went to see Florence and the Machine. It was like in the spring.
But then when I say, so let's go back to the beginning. So imagine I was with you. What would I have seen, you know, heard, thought, smelled, touched, tasted, or walked through it backwards? The overall result is they have very little to say.
Do you remember the car ride home?
Not really.
They will say things like, well, pretty much just like I told you before, and they will repeat very closely the same thing they've already told me, so that I'm not learning anything new over time.
The thing is, I don't even really remember.
It's sort of like comparing a digital photograph of your house with the tree in the front yard and a child's picture of it, where there's a house and there's a tree and there's clouds and there's birds, but there's not a lot of detail. And what we tend to do when people tell us lies is, I think, we fill in the blanks.
And that, Morgan says, is where the problem lies. We fill in the blanks because, of course, we want to believe people. So Andy Morgan's challenge was to find a way to take these interviews and analyze them without filling in the blanks. To do this, he had to put a little distance between himself and the interesting person telling the story.
The way we've analyzed that in most of our studies is we record the interviews and we do a transcript and we let the computer just count the number of words that comes out of a person's mouth in the interview and the number of unique words that comes out of their mouth. That so if you think about the phrase, one small step for man.
That's one small step for man.
One giant leap for mankind.
One giant leap for mankind.
There are 10 words, but you've used one and four twice. So there's only 8 unique words. As you're thinking harder about monitoring what you're saying, it has the side effect of reducing the richness of what you have to say and shortens the thing that you have to say. All the computer is doing is counting those two variables. And when we sort people based on those two variables, response length and unique word count, the computer's right, typically 80 to 85% of the time. Whereas our professional raters, whether they come from Homeland Security or the FBI or the DIA or other intelligence groups or law enforcement, our human raters are rarely better than 54% correct.
It's kind of a crazy idea that someone with a transcript and a tally sheet could tell us whether or not what we're remembering is accurate, while someone with decades of FBI interrogation training could be flying blind. And this idea could have all sorts of huge implications. Think about a jury. A jury is just a bunch of people trying to figure out who to believe. But people, according to Andy Morgan, are terrible at figuring out who to believe. Isn't it possible that a juror with a transcript of the trial, who's never laid eyes on the accused, might actually do a better job at figuring out who's lying, who to trust? For Andy Morgan's part, he's glad our bodies aren't the end-all be-all.
It's reassuring to know that although there's so many books on nonverbal behavior and people say 90% of communication is nonverbal, based on the science, I think that the best way to sort out the truth is to listen to what people have to say.
And to know that maybe our fate won't hang on sweaty palms or a pounding heart, that our words really do matter. Thanks to Andy Morgan, who's a forensic psychologist at Yale. And just in case you were curious, during his interview with us, he used more than 7,200 words, and enough unique words to make us trust he wasn't lying. The show is produced by Lauren Spohr, Eric Mennel, and me. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal.
That was Pants on Fire by Criminal, and you can find all their episodes at thisiscriminal.com. I particularly liked Gil from London, which involves a catfish-style scenario that gets a bit too close to home. But I think my favourite is Triassic Park, about the theft of petrified wood from a national park. Before we go, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is Welsh onion. Noun. An Asian onion that forms clusters of slender bulbs which resemble spring onions. I don't care, why is it a Welsh onion when it's an Asian onion? From German, Welsh, meaning foreign. Yeah, but you capitalise the W in Welsh, which strongly implies the onion's from Wales, which is nowhere near Asia, so I don't know why you would deliberately mislead me like that, dictionary. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with huge thanks to Lauren Sporer and Phoebe Judge of Criminal, and to Russ Henry for production help. Martin Austwick did the music. You can find me at Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and theallusionist.org, where I'll be back next week with more Radiotopians.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Crimillusionist.
No, you lost a syllable. Crimillusionist.
Okay. I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Crimillusionist.
No.
What? What? You do it.
Crimillusionist.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Crimillusionist. No, I've done the wrong thing.
So close.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Crimillusionist.